Yup, yup. What's going on, world? And yes, the rumors are all true. We are officially on the air. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Breathe Faith and Creativity Podcast. My name is Derek Ngoy, and I am a poet, a spoken word artist, a writer, and pastor of the branch in the beautiful city of Long Beach, California. And I guess I am also now a podcaster. This pod has actually been in the lab for the past 2 years. It began as a dream around the same time my fourth publication came out. Incidentally, that book was also entitled Breathe, and so I am really excited to see this podcast take flight. It's somewhat of a birthing moment for me, and I'm really giddy to see this thing maturate and grow over the coming years. So I want you all to celebrate with me in this next season of my life. But before we get into it, I want to lay out some foundational cement, if you will. Number one, this podcast will exist in a seasons type formatting, which means we'll have roughly around 12 to 24 episodes per season. We'll take a break for a few months and then come back, just so that I'm not stressed out about trying to produce 52 episodes in the year. So stay tuned for that. And second, juxtaposing my belief in God through Jesus with my role as both a poet and a pastor in the community, I'm really interested in exploring ways that other people of faith live out their journey within the context of creativity. And my hunch is, when the two worlds collide, there's a ton of fodder for positive growth in the areas of spirituality, emotion, community, healing, and so much more toward the advancement of bettering the human experience this side of heaven. So, with that said, I'm hoping that you will subscribe to this podcast and join me on this journey to breathe and to discover faith and creativity along the way. There you have it, my first teaser, y'all. Let's get at it.
Welcome to the Breathe Podcast, where we explore the intersection of faith and creativity. We interview artists from all walks of life to discover how faith plays a role in their art and expression, hoping to encourage you to live a life of creativity and faith. And now, your host, poet, writer, and pastor, Derek Ngoy.
Man, you like that? You like that smooth beat? By the way, that beat was composed by none other than yours truly, so enjoy it. By the way, that fabulous voice you heard in the intro is none other than voiceover artist Kevin Horton. Kevin was a recent Society of Voice Arts and Sciences Award nominee for Best Voiceover for Outstanding Movie Trailer for the work he did on the movie You Ride. And we're actually going to have him on the pod soon, so stay tuned for that. It's going to be a wonderful interview with him. And before we get into the broadcast today, I want to let you know about the Patreon page that we have. If you go to patreon.com/Derek Ngoy, there are many levels of support that you can choose from, but we just ask, if you continue in the journey with us, that you support this podcast in any way that you can. This is a listener-supported show, so we need your support to keep this podcast going, to cover some of the costs that goes into producing a show like this. And for as little as $1 a month, that's right, $1 a month, you along with the greater community can keep this podcast going. So head on over to the Patreon page, patreon.com/Derek Ngoy. And there are many different levels, like I said, of support, which not only will you be able to support this podcast, but you're also going to be able to support a lot of the works that I have coming up with other books and other poetry ventures that I have planned. So today on this inaugural show, our very first episode, we have an amazing treat for y'all. We have the joy and the honor of chatting with Micah Borne. Micah is a poet, a spoken word artist. He's a creative writing teacher, lover of Jesus, pursuer of justice. His latest works include a hip hop album entitled A Time Like This and an anthology that consists of 30 diverse authors called Fight Evil with Poetry. Dude's an all round guy, and I'm blessed to call him family. Micah, welcome to the show and thanks for making time to be with us today. What's up?
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So how about we start off with some basic intros? Maybe there's someone out there who's not familiar with your work. Maybe you can unpack where you've been, where you're from.
a couple of your influences, just basic brief bio to get us a little bit familiar with who you are.
Born and raised in the LBC.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I'm a Long Beach local, and I just grew up under the influence of hip hop. So I've been listening to rap music since as long as I can remember. I had older siblings that were heavy into it. So I grew up listening, but I didn't start writing until college. My freshman year, I started writing rap songs with a couple of homies in my dorm room. And then my third year of college, I got introduced to spoken word poetry. I'd seen it on YouTube, but I'd never seen it in person until a friend of mine invited me to an open mic. And so I fell in love with it. And I always have written both music and poetry since I started writing. Most people know me for my spoken word. But I just see myself as a creative writer because I'll experiment in any genre. I did a blues album a couple years ago. I partner with other vocalists who sing pop or gospel or any type of things. And I just like the challenge of writing in new forms that I haven't experimented with yet.
Yeah, that's cool. So how about some of your earlier influences in poetry?
Honestly, I didn't have any. I was home for the summer. I went to college in Chicago, but I was home for the summer and I got invited to the Poetry Lounge up in LA that happens every Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. Super dope open mic. And I didn't grow up listening to spoken word poets. I didn't grow up reading famous page poets. You know, we had to read a little bit of Shakespeare and Robert Frost and Emily Dickinson in school. And that was pretty much the extent of my knowledge of poetry. So when I went to this open mic, just at the invitation of a friend, I was just bored. I was like, I'm not doing nothing on Tuesday night. Sure, whatever. But I wasn't all excited about poetry. But when I got there to see the people that I felt were telling stories that connected to me, because all the other poetry I'd been exposed to just seemed like from such a different world, or literally was from, decades and decades ago or centuries ago. And I didn't feel connected to it. But suddenly it was a bunch of folks, not only young, but young folks included, people of color, using language that I understood, telling stories that I related to. And so I fell in love more with the community of open mics, not so much with the really well-known, famous spoken word poets or successful poets. It was just like, man, not even... Everybody wasn't even good as far as the quality of the writing or performance, right, but I still appreciated what they were saying because they were saying things that I thought I was the only person in the world who felt that way. Or I thought, you can't say that in public. Everybody's going to think you're crazy or judge you. And that wasn't happening. People were being honest and people were applauding them for their vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, man, I feel you. I feel you. I've been through that. And so that's what I really fell in love with. And it was interesting because the first couple of years of writing poetry and going to open mics, it never even crossed my mind that people did this for a living. Like, yeah. I knew poets existed, but with spoken word, I was like, poetry is already such a niche subculture, and then spoken word is a subculture of that.
Yeah.
So I wasn't aware of like National Poetry Slam. I wasn't aware of none of that stuff. And so I didn't have any influences, to be honest. My only influences were really just the open mics I would go to and hearing the other like local no-name poets that were just honest and real.
Yeah. So it was more like homegrown for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. So then you go to Poetry Lounge on summer break from school and you go back to school. Mm-hmm. And so at what point did you start utilizing this format to express yourself or to share whatever it is, what was on your heart and your mind?
Oh, it was right away. Like literally that night that I went to the Poetry Lounge, I went home that night and I said, I'm going to write a spoken word poem. And I wanted to go specifically back to the Poetry Lounge and share it. Uh-huh. And I did go back once, but I got there too late. The list was full and never got to share it. So then I was on this mission to like spit it somewhere.
Yeah.
So that was right towards the end of the summer. So I get back to Chicago and that city got open mics all over the place. Like the spoken word scene there is heavy.
Right.
And so I just started going to open mics at any coffee shop, anyone I could find. And I just jumped right in. Like that's all I did. I just jumped in. Or if our campus had some type of open mic or talent show, I just started doing that. I had already like made a few connections because I had been rapping for a couple of years. So I was like doing a few gigs around Chicago for hip hop. And then I would just throw a poem into the set at the end.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So I mentioned at the top of the show, you have your album, A Time Like This, and your recent anthology, Fight Evil with Poetry. What are some current projects you got going on that perhaps we can look out for?
I got a lot. I can't really speak about some of them in detail.
Yeah.
I don't know when, but I am working on a book, my first book of poetry, full length. I'm working on two different albums right now, another solo hip hop project, and then a collaborative album with my homegirl Lucy, who featured on A Time Like This. Yeah. But that one is not, that one's not going to be hip hop. I really don't actually know what it's going to be. We've been experimenting a lot with different sounds. And we've been gigging a lot, like kind of acoustically, but we're going to get pretty creative in the studio. So I'm excited. So yeah, I have a book coming. Who knows when, but I've made some good progress on it. And then, yeah, the project with Lucy and my other solo project.
So what I find very interesting, you mentioned that you relatively got into the spoken word, I guess, art form recently, if you will, comparatively to the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And, but you have more spoken word albums than you do the hip hop album. I don't even know what I want to ask, but I just thought it was something to point out. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, I have two spoken word albums.
Yeah.
I actually have, I have one full length rap album, but I actually have three rap projects out.
Okay.
So I have like two EPs. The first one, which I took down off the internet because I don't want nobody to know about it. So if you got it, you already know you got it. I still got some copies in my thing. But I mean, there's a reason for that. So like my very first project was a 5-track EP of hip hop.
Okay.
And then the thing was, honestly, like I was just focusing on where the opportunities were.
Got it.
And for whatever reason, you know, like hip hop, like, you could be super dope, but there's a billion rappers. That's just true. Everybody wants to rap.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a problem at all, personally. But
So were you on Hollywood trying to slang those EPs?
Nah, I wasn't even living in California at the time. But it was like, with spoken word, I just found the spaces I was doing it in, there was just more opportunities.
Right.
And so I was like, well, people keep inviting me to do this. And so that's what I'm going to focus on. But also, I'm not going to lie, so I did put out two hip hop EPs over the years. Because I grew up listening to hip hop, mm-hmm. and I have such a strong emotional, sentimental connection to it,
yeah.
I put more pressure on myself
yeah.
for my first full length album. It was like, okay, spoken word. I didn't even know this existed until I was 20 years old. This is fun. This is experimental. I didn't care that much. Like, not that I didn't take it seriously or want it to be good, but I didn't have like 20 years of you better represent, you better make your city proud. You better, you know,
yeah.
it was like, oh, this is an experiment. But with hip hop, like I could drop an EP, but with that first album, you know, I'm like, ah, it's gotta be dope. And I mean, so I think that's why it took me a little longer to get A Time Like This out. But I'm very proud of it. It came at the right time.
You should be.
Yeah.
It's really good.
So, appreciate it, man.
Yeah. So speaking of hip hop, really quickly, who are some of your hip hop influences?
So this is the thing. So the rappers I grew up loving, they're influential in the sense of like, they helped me fall in love with the art form. Mm-hmm. I always had tension because I was a church kid. I was at church every Sunday, every Wednesday night, like youth group outings, all that stuff. But I also wasn't deeply in love with gangster rap music. And it was always this guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
so it was like, I know, like that's the thing, yo. At the time that I was growing up in Long Beach specifically, you know, some of the West Coast was running. I don't care what nobody say. West Coast at the time was running the hip hop game, and specifically gangster rappers. Like, wasn't nobody listening to no conscious rappers? Like, nobody out here wanted to hear Common, Uplift Yo People. Like, nobody wanted to hear. For the most part,
yeah,
like people
it.
Is like bumping like gangsta stuff, you know, NWA, Ice Cube, you know, DJ Quick. Like that's like, if it wasn't gangsta, it wasn't rap.
Yeah.
Like that's like, that's the version, the brand of hip hop I grew up with. Yeah. You know, I wasn't listening to no Talib Kweli, no Mos Def, nothing like that. I honestly didn't even know who these cats was other than just their names, you know, like, and so all that to say is like, I kind of grew up, I knew that like as an art form, it was beautiful, but the particular kind of subset of hip hop I listened to, I wouldn't say they were really influential when I started writing because I'm like, well, I love gangster rap, but I am not a gangster and I am not about to make no gangster rap. But stylistically, I guess, even in my spoken word, to be honest, like a lot of people is like, you know, you could be pretty intense at times and aggressive. And I mean, I definitely probably got that from gangster rap. Cause when I first started rapping, yo, like I was like, super aggressive. I was super aggressive. Yeah. It was crazy. Yeah.
No, that's cool. So switching gears a little bit, you recently went on tour with Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin for their book, Beating Guns, Hope for People Who Are Weary of Violence. Go get it, by the way. Can you talk a little bit about that book and what the tour was about and your experience on that tour?
Yeah, it was a really good experience, a really tough experience. Shane and Michael, they really did their research. And, you know, when you say gun violence, a lot of people will think of either mass shootings or gang violence, you know, street crime type stuff as the main expressions of it. And that's just not true. Mm. I learned a lot on the tour as they were talking about their book and doing the presentations on it that, you know, 2/3 of gun deaths in America are suicide. Mm-hmm. 2/3. That's a lot. And so they were just, a lot of it was debunking the myths around guns. And one of the main reasons people want to have them is like protection, right? Yeah. This concept of protection. But statistically speaking, if you have a firearm in your home, it is way more likely that that gun will be used to hurt yourself or someone you love than it would to protect your family. You know, like most people go their whole lives and their house never gets broken into, you know, and so it's just like, actually, if you're really looking at the numbers, owning this gun is putting your family at risk. Mm. Because no matter how generally healthy someone may be, like we all go through it. There's all times in our lives where we might have a thought like, man, I don't want to live anymore. And when something is so easily accessible, you can make a poor decision, you know? So it was that, it was, but they were talking about it from a very, I think balanced way, you know, cause Shane is someone, who grew up in Tennessee. He grew up hunting. He wasn't like, I hate guns. It was like, yo, I grew up with this culture. Yeah. I understand there is a way to enjoy it that seems like fine and healthy and good, but we do have a crisis. And so they were talking about it from just angles that I hadn't really thought about. And so it was good to be there and to be able to be a part of it. I was sharing some poetry of my own and some other folks' poetry as well. It was a beautiful time. Yeah.
Now, you said it was a tough experience. How so?
It was tough because, I mean, when you're talking about gun violence, you're talking about death. You're talking about, the tour, they intentionally picked cities, not every single stop, but a lot of the stops were places that had been affected by mass shootings or had experienced a mass shooting. So, or some type of gun violence. So every night of the tour, if we could find someone in the city, they would have someone tell a story. And so, you know, whether it was a student who was present at a school that had a shooting or it was someone whose parent committed suicide, you know, there was someone whose dad killed his wife and then killed himself. Wow. You know, and so it was like telling those stories of those folks, hearing that, it was hard, but it was necessary conversation.
Yeah. In a recent interview, Shane said this. He said there are more gun dealers in America than there are McDonald's restaurants.
Yeah.
Why do you think our country is so infatuated with guns?
I have no clue. I literally don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
So, right, a few months ago, the thing that happened in New Zealand and, you know, with the mosques getting, you know, the mass shooting that happened there, and the prime minister nearly 24 hours later, said, and I quote, let me quote this. She said, on March 15th, our history changed forever. Now our laws will too. We are announcing action today on behalf of all New Zealanders to strengthen our gun laws and make our country a safer place. Now, as easy as it was for New Zealand to make that move, why do you think it's still an issue here? Why, and again, it's all in the lawmakers' hands, I guess, or the law people's hands. But why do you think it's so hard here in America to be as active in that sense as it was in New Zealand to just change laws just like that?
Well, a couple things. I'm sure they have distinctions in the way their government is set up in a practical sense. But over here, the thing is, you're not just fighting laws, you're fighting culture.
Yeah.
And we have such a deep and long history and affinity for guns. And we have these narratives that we tell ourselves that guns protect us instead of endanger us. Mm-hmm. And so it's really like, it's really, honestly, relatively, it's simpler, I should say, maybe not easy. It's simpler to change a law, but it's like culture is stubborn. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like you can say segregation is no longer legal and folks is like, we are not allowing these black kids in these schools. And they had to freaking send in, you know, the federal troops. It's like, all right, like, and that culture still didn't change and still hasn't changed in a lot of places. Yeah. Right. And so I think, yeah, like we really gotta touch people's hearts as well as, change the laws, because I just don't think New Zealand is fighting that as much. Like they didn't, I mean, yeah, they don't have that history.
Yeah. So kind of tying in the spiritual aspect to this discussion. So being that you're a man of faith, what do you think the Christian response, or let's just say that those who claim the name of Christ, what do you think our response should be when it comes to guns and gun violence?
I mean, I think we need to educate ourselves because, first of all, like, most people just don't know that much about it. And I say myself included, like, I learned so much on this tour. And I think we often just kind of fall into, on any given issue, the beliefs of our tribe, right? So whether that tribe is your family or your spiritual community, your church, you know, it's just kind of like, on things that we haven't done a lot of research ourselves, we just kind of adopt whatever our parents believe or whatever our friends believe. Yeah. And at this point, it's just too important to like, just go with the flow on stuff like this when folks is dying. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to like say, well, this should be the Christian response, because this is something that is relatively new to me in the sense of I'm familiar with gun culture, unfortunately, but as far as really thinking of the path forward or how we can talk about it in a way that isn't just polarizing and getting nowhere. So, but yeah, I mean, I really would suggest that book. They did a lot of research on it. You know?
Yeah. And I just think it just speaks to the entire, just education as a whole, even because outside of gun violence, I just see that in Christianity as well. It's just kind of like, this is what we believe. We're just going to go with the flow without even knowing what you believe, right? It's just
absolutely,
you know, perhaps maybe you can speak on that and kind of switching gears a little bit in terms of faith itself. How do Christians move forward, perhaps, especially in a time like this, where there's just a lot of religious wars going on, you know, and what can Christians do? Obviously it's education, but what can Christians do to actually move forward in just life and understanding what they believe and how they can live it out?
Yeah. I mean, I would kind of make the category a little smaller, just to speak to just what I know. And that is like, well, Christianity in this American context, I can 100% say has been hijacked by white supremacy and white privilege. Most of our Christian institutions, have very slanted views. And so I think if you are someone who identifies as the Christian, the first thing you need to do is really to allow the voices, the theologians, the pastors, the speakers to reflect the whole of humanity, to start listening to other traditions of the Christian faith, which is ancient and diverse and global and Asian and African. Yeah. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's like most of us just grew up on Christian radio. The preachers was white men. The music was by white folks. If you went to a Christian college, it's likely that most of the theologians they taught, you know, I went to a Christian school studying Christianity in an American context and never read a single book by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, right, who is one of the most important Christians in American history, right? We read a bunch of old white dudes, you know, so like that type of privilege in our theology, white people, white Christians think that, oh, they just, that's just orthodox theology. No, it's white theology.
Right.
When you're only listening to white dudes and you're only reading white theologians, then your theology is going to be slanted. Just like if every, you know, and most of my professors too at this Christian school I went to, it's like, if I went to a school and all of the professors were Asian women and we only read Asian women theologians and philosophers and 90% of the students were Asian, I would be like, what?
Right.
What is up with this school? Like, why do you have this slant? But when the numbers like that are white, even though it was a school in the middle of a big diverse city like Chicago, nobody blinks an eye. And everybody thinks this is normal. It's like, nah, there is a very clear bias here.
Yeah.
You know, so I think for me, that's the journey I've been on over the last few years, is both with theology, but also just all the things I'm learning. I like reading philosophy, reading poetry, all these things. So I want to make sure that the things I'm reading are reflective of the whole human family so that, I have balanced perspectives. And so, yeah, I started really just like seeking it out. I'm like, I want to read some, you know, theology by, like I said, I'm using that because this is an example that I did, like Asian women. And there's like, there's a book called Asian Feminist Theology. Mm. Like, oh, cool. Let me read that. Cause I definitely did not get taught that in seminary or Bible college, you know?
Yeah.
And so stuff like that, you know, be proactive.
No, yeah, I appreciate that. I recently spoke at Fuller Seminary and it was all about missiology. And it was interesting because everyone on the panel were all people of color, right? It even had, and I forgot what tribe. I try not to say Native American. I want to pay honor to where they're from, right? So but you had, let's just say she was a Cherokee, right? But she was a Cherokee theologian, you know, and you don't hear that often, right? And I love that. I love that about you where it's not just so, I guess tunnel vision is the word, and you really wanted to expand, you know, cause at the end of the day, and I try to preach this from the pulpit on Sundays is, look, we're image bearers of God. We're not just one specific skin color of God, but we are image bearers. And whatever that means, that really opens my mind. And that should open all of our minds that, yeah, maybe following Jesus is more than just this little bubble that we've been a part of for so long. You know? So yeah, thanks for sharing that. Let's switch gears back to poetry a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about, your anthology. There are 30 poets on there?
Yeah.
Yeah. How? I guess it's my question. How were you able to get that many poets into one creative space, which I think is an amazing feat? Yeah. Can you talk to a little bit about the inception of Fight Evil with Poetry and just how you're able to gather so many amazing minds?
Yeah. Where the idea came from is honestly, I was just feeling discouraged after the election, after everything. And I was just like, I have to do something because I felt like I was on the brink of like my despair is about to get the best of me. And so instead of trying to fix the world or the nation, I was like, let me just do what I know. And that is poetry. And so I reached out to one of my homeboys who's the co-editor and is also a poet. And I said, man, I want to do something. I want to speak to all the different justice issues, because there's so many things that need to be addressed. And so that's when we came up with the idea. And so the anthology is 30 poets from all kind of different backgrounds, faiths, sexual orientations. And I just asked them to send me poetry about justice, very broad. And then if you buy it online, 100% of the proceeds from the online sales go to two different nonprofit organizations. So it's a very literal, like, you buy this poetry and we give it to organizations that are pushing back against the injustices in the world. But honestly, how I put it together, it was easier than I thought.
Yeah.
Only because I'm like, dang, like, I realized for a lot of my friends who aren't poets, I'm like the only poet they know. But when I had this idea, like within 5 minutes, I had a list of almost 50 poets.
Wow.
Like just that I personally know, like not even like poets that I admire and wanted to be in it. It was just like, dang, I just in my cell phone contacts, I got like freaking like 80 poets. I was like, dang, this is crazy. Like, and then I was like thinking about my whole life. Like, do I hang out with non-poets at all? But anyways, but yeah, man, I just threw the invitation out there. But we did want to be intentional because, so there's 30 poets in it, but 20 of them are women. Mm-hmm. And we did that on purpose because we wanted to make sure we highlighted voices that were not often heard. And we also were very intentional about who we invited. I had a lot of good friends that I didn't invite to be a part of it, not because they weren't dope, but because I'm like, okay, I'm a straight black dude. I got a lot of homies who can spit hot fire, but like, we don't freaking need 7 of us in here. Yeah. You know, like we only need a couple. And then we need to make sure we make room for other voices.
Yeah.
And so that actually was one of the hardest parts of like, man, I don't want folks to get insulted if they don't get an invitation, because right. for the fellas, since we wanted it to be like a heavier representation of women's voices, we only had 10 dudes in there. Mm-hmm. And so there weren't that many spots. You know, I know a gang of poets. But then also it was cool because we were able to find some talent that we were unaware of, because I invited some friends, but then we did a open basically submission for women only. And so we wasn't really expecting to get that many dope folks. We thought we'll maybe take one or two people from the submissions, but we added a good amount of people from that submission process because they just sent us some fire work.
Yeah.
So it was dope. Yeah.
So you're reading all these submissions. And I know that you talked about, you know, speaking out against the injustices, whatever their context might be. But is there like a common theme that you saw as you read these pieces that perhaps stood out?
No, I mean, they were all over the place, which is what I liked. There was a lot of different things. But one thing I appreciated, though, was a lot of people decided to submit work that wasn't necessarily directly affecting them, which I thought it was dope.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like you kind of just expect the black poets to talk about black issues. Mm. And some of them did. But like you expect, like a lot of the fellas were writing about women's issues. A lot of the, you know, a lot of the people that I expected to submit a certain type of work, they didn't necessarily do that. Mm. Like it was still justice oriented, but it was like, oh, I wasn't expecting this from you.
Right.
And then there's other things that maybe don't come to mind right away when you think justice, but they do fall under the umbrella.
Yeah.
One of the poets in there, Vanessa, she submitted a poem about her experience being diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. and surviving, but like the community that came around her in that time in her life. And it's just like, oh, you know, this isn't about, you know, white supremacy or unequal pay for women, but it was like, yeah, like this is justice. This is peace in the world. This is a group of friends rallying around a person who's in a hard time. And so it's like other poems like that where you're like, oh man, like this is really dope.
That's, you know? Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, like writing poetry, is a healing process for me, right? I've had bouts with depression and suicide in the past. And for me, writing brings healing, and this is where I kind of want to collide faith and healing. So what I love about Jesus is he was able to use his words to in many ways bring healing to people, right? He embraced people who the greater society rejected, right? I think of, you know, the woman caught in the act of adultery, or I think of even lepers and people who the greater society just rejected, and he was able to use his words in a way that embraced people. And And you juxtapose that with poetry and experiencing healing. I guess the question that I want to ask you is, how have you experienced healing in your writing? And perhaps how has your writing how has your writing helped to heal others?
Yeah. It's a good question. I feel like, another reason I did appreciate the vulnerability I saw that first night I went to the lounge.
Mm.
But another thing that motivated me to be a part of it was that night particularly, and I've seen this at other open mics too. There is a lot of praising of vulnerability, but sometimes it's like, that's it.
Okay.
And I think that's a necessary first step.
Yeah.
But there's gotta be something after that. Not because I'm optimistic and can't, like, I write certain poems that, you know, that don't have a bow and don't have any resolve because in that moment on that issue. But when you look at the whole of my work as a person of faith, like, I do believe that the power of truth and love and goodness is stronger, than the evils in this world, than the injustice in this world, you know? And so I want you to see that hope in my work. But I do want to reflect the realities. But like, there's this quote that's attributed to Ernest Hemingway, but it's been around a lot. I've heard other folks say it was other people, but, it basically says, there is nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed. And I understand the sentiment, but I really disagree with that.
Okay.
I strongly disagree with that. I think although it is good to process your pain through your writing, in some ways it's the lowest hanging fruit, right? Like, I think when you're going through it, it's like, oh yeah, just bleeding hearts. But fact of the matter is, I ended up writing this older piece after hearing that quote called Beauty is Beautiful Too. And the thing is, it's actually more natural when you think about it for beautiful experiences to inspire beauty than always making beauty from ashes, right? Like, yes, you can be going through it and depressed and your lover, you know, left you or your loved one died. But like also, like, you know, when I'm playing with my nephews, you know, or when I walk outside and it's just so beautiful that like everything I'm feeling just disappears because I feel that cool breeze and that California sun. You know, it's like, beauty is beautiful too. Yeah. It's like, and it's important, not just because I want things to be good, but to actually reflect the whole experience of human life. And as a person of faith, of my experience of faith as well. And so it's like, yes, I think like often Christian artists err on the other side of where they're always just talking about the goodness and the love and the beauty, and they're afraid to keep it real.
Yeah.
Right. But then there's also that, you know, what I experienced at open mics a lot where everything is just bleeding hearts and like hopelessness. And I'm like, I know some of y'all. We was laughing, you know what I'm saying? Just last week, we went to lunch and we was cracking up and we watched movies and we, you know what I'm saying? Like, life is beautiful and life is tough. But at the end of the day, I think, that the healing really just comes from the honesty and from art that reflects all of life. And when you really do that, you're reminded that no matter how things may seem or may feel in the moment, you feel them intensely, but there is a lot of beauty, and I would say more beauty. And I, again, for me, with Fight Evil with Poetry, like, it sounds like, oh, cool catchphrase, but at the end of the day, all I'm saying is I believe that, you know, that beauty is stronger than ugliness, that truth is stronger than lies, that love is stronger than hate. So why would we not use the stronger weapon? And so when you reflect all of the realities of the universe, I do believe love comes out on top.
Good. And so one thing that popped to mind when you're talking about beauty was one of your pieces on your album called Freak Show. And it's one of my favorite one of my favorite pieces that you have. Can you unpack that a little bit? Can you just unpack that a little bit?
Absolutely. Freak Show was actually inspired by another poem by one of my favorite poets named Anis Mojgani. And Anis has this pretty well-known spoken word piece called Shake the Dust. And Shake the Dust is dedicated to anyone who for any reason feels like a social outcast. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning of the poem, he goes, "This is for the fat girls," because he knows we live in a culture that makes bigger people feel less than for no reason, right? Yeah. And he goes, "This one's for, you know, the kid who gets bullied at school or the kid who wears glasses and gets called four eyes. Shake the dust, shake the dust." And you're listening to this poem and you're like, "Oh yeah, this is beautiful. Like, yeah, stand up for the little people, all that stuff." And it's a really easy poem to love. But then he gets to the middle of the poem and he has this line that stops me dead in my tracks. And he says, "For the celibate pedophile who keeps on struggling, shake the dust." And I remember the first time that line sunk in, it really hit me because it was the first time I ever thought to put myself in the shoes of an adult who might be plagued with experiencing sexual attraction towards children, yeah. Right? If this is your reality, every time you hear someone like you brought up in casual conversation with friends, on TV, on the news, in a movie, in church, in a sermon, the only thing you hear is ill, gross, disgusting, menace to society, lock them up. How could anyone even think about doing that to a child? You're a monster. I hope you die and burn in hell. I hope you rot in jail. It'd be better if you were never born. It is culturally acceptable and even seen as morally right to hate, to be thoroughly disgusted by the very existence of someone like you.
Yeah.
If this is your reality, right? And so how lonely must that be if you are trying to fight this thing? Who can you trust? Who can you talk to about that struggle without feeling like they're going to judge you, right? Yeah. And the thing I loved and I thought was so brilliant about Anis is he took a firm stance on the justice of the issue. He said, "To the celibate pedophile who keeps on struggling, I need you. I expect you to fight this thing and to hold that line. But at the same time, I can't imagine how lonely that must be," yeah. Right? And so when I heard that, it challenged me as a person of Christian faith, because the more I understand the faith of Jesus and the life of Jesus, I think at the core of it is loving your enemies. Yeah. And when we say enemies, like, we don't have a strong concept of enemies these days. We think of like that person at work who gets on our nerves. But the reality is it's really the person who has most offended your humanity, who has most dehumanized you, to love them. Because to go back with the example he gave, it's like, yo, if you're a pedophile or you have, whether you've acted on it in the past or not, but you're fighting that thing and you hear people always just condemning you, condemning you, condemning you, condemning you, what's going to be more encouraging and motivate you to change and to keep fighting? Someone just telling you you're a piece of crap, mm-hmm. or someone saying, "Man, that must be hard. Please, for the good of all of us, keep fighting. Yeah. We're proud of you. It's a good thing you exist. You shouldn't just rot in prison or burn in hell. You know, your life is valuable." And to love someone like that, even though they may have hurt other people or they're thinking about hurting people or you find them gross, I'm like, that actually is a more effective way to combat injustice, to love people into what is right. And so that's kind of where that poem comes from, but it gives a lot of different, it kind of pairs a lot of different people who would be seen as mortal enemies. Like, no way in hell would these two people ever be reconciled, like a slave and a slave master, like a woman who was raped and her rapist, mm-hmm. right? But I do believe that forgiveness and healing and love is available to everyone.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is anyone who has done anything that is beyond the grace of God. That's my belief.
Yeah.
Not everyone will respond to that, but it is available to everyone. And so, yeah, I think there is hope for the rapist. I think there is hope for the slave master. I think there is hope for everybody. And that's uncomfortable. And I have total respect and understanding for anyone who rejects that idea. But I think that's what made Christianity so radical. And, you know, as the Bible says, like, as Christianity was spreading, they said, those who have turned the world upside down came here too. Yeah. Because it really was. It was the first shall be last. It was love your enemies. It was, this doesn't make any sense. What do you mean love your enemies? They're trying to kill us. They're trying to hurt us.
Yeah.
Why would we love them?
Like, you Jesus, know? You want me to love the Roman Empire? Like, what the heck? What's wrong with you? You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to kind of relate it back to America and more current context, I remember when I did actually read some, Dr. King, there's this story that just blows my mind. And he was in a meeting and he got a call and they said, Dr. King, there's a phone call for you. And he goes, I'm in a meeting. He's like, no, this is important. So he left the meeting, picks up the phone, and they said, you need to come home. A bomb just went off at your house and your whole family was home, your wife and your kids. And he rushes home. He doesn't know how they're doing. He gets to his house. Thankfully, his family was in the back of the house. Someone threw a bomb through the front window. It landed in the living room and exploded. Mm-hmm. And by the time he got there, there was a mob of very angry black folk. I say mob crowd, really. And they were understandably upset.
Yeah.
And they wanted to go riot and burn down the white part of town. And he gets out in front of his house that's all blown up and he says, brothers and sisters, we will not be overcome by evil. We will overcome evil with good. Mm-hmm. We will love our enemies. We are Christians. Wow. That's what we do. Now, this is the thing. And this is kind of going back to something we talked about earlier. Like, I've been around church. I heard many a white preacher says, the Bible say, love your enemy. Jesus say, love your enemy. Blah, 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 blah. That never sunk in with the weight of what it actually means until I read it then. And I saw this black American man moments after they tried to murder his whole family say, we're going to love our enemies. And if there is any ever a time to justify, you know, you know, and it's like, imagine what would have happened if he would be like, oh no, y'all done went too far. Get your guns. Let's go. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, it's totally understandable if he would have made that shift, but he held that line. And that nonviolent movement, that stubborn hope in the power of love to overcome the very real violence and hate that they were facing is what changed the nation, you know, and changed the world and inspired so many people. So, that's what Freak Show is about. It's not, again, it's not just loving your enemies and the people you kind of don't like, but it's people who want to kill you, people who have hurt you, to say, it's not just because it's the right thing to do. That's the thing. It's not just the moral high road, but it is the only hope we have in changing. When you're just punishing people, that doesn't necessarily change their hearts.
No.
When you love people, despite the fact that they have tried to murder you or have killed people you love or hated people you love, it confronts them. It confuses them, you know? And it's like, that is the strongest and most powerful transforming tool we have on the human heart is love.
Yeah. That's so good. And I think that's why I really, really love that piece. And
of words from a portrait of Jesus becoming again. And all sing, oh Lord, oh grace, and all sing, oh Lord, oh grace.
Never dismiss the visions of madmen. Wisdom can be gathered from anyone who sees what others cannot. Drunk men tell no tales. Poets cannot lie. Poets cannot lie because we do not divide fact from fiction. There's often more truth in our fantasy worlds and metaphors than human courts where liars swear to speak honestly in the name of laws they break, in the name of gods they disobey. The prayers of the proud will never reach heaven, but God hears the slurred words of the stumbling prophets, and all will be cursed who mock them. It is not an easy task to plead with the world, to grieve for the world.
And so, yeah, I mean, thank you for that. And I think, you know, with that said, I think that's a good note to end. But we do this thing, on the show where we do this lightning round mm-hmm. to end the show, just to kind of like,
Let's do it.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you two choices, a couple of different options, and then just shoot me your first response to these choices. Cool.
I'm down.
All right. Here we go. Hot or cold?
Cold.
Instagram or Facebook?
Instagram.
Paper or plastic?
Paper.
Side streets or freeway?
Side streets.
Books or Kindle?
Books.
Fox News or CNN?
Neither.
Chicago or Oregon?
Oh, Chicago.
Kobe or Bryant? Or Kobe or Jordan?
Kobe or Bryant? Hey, we know where you're from, bro. Kobe or Bryant?
The Lakers.
The Lakers.
And we'll just leave it at that. Drake or Kanye?
Oh, man. Now Drake. Would have been Kanye up until the last couple years, but yeah. Now Drake.
Big Daddy Kane or Rakim?
Bruh, I'm from the West Coast. I didn't grow up on them cats.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Eazy-E or Ice Cube?
Oh, Ice Cube.
Micah 9 or AC Alone?
I haven't listened to Micah 9, so I would say AC Alone. I've heard more of his music.
Donnie Jackson or Saul Williams?
Oh, I mean, Saul Williams. Yeah.
Well, there you go. Lightning round. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for playing, Micah. And thank you so much for taking time to be on with us today. Really appreciate you. Really quickly, for those who aren't familiar to where to find you, can you tell us where we can find you on social media?
Yeah, everything is just my name. My Instagram is Micah Bournet, MicahBournes. My website is MicahBournet.com, Facebook, Micah Bournet. And then also you can check out stuff. Fight Evil with Poetry has an Instagram and a website, and it's all just FightEvilWithPoetry.com, Fight Evil with Poetry on Instagram. Yeah.
Cool. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Micah Bournet, make sure you check him out on social media and support his work. And please, please make sure you rate and review this podcast, as well as go on the Patreon page. Until next time, be the light, extend your hand in love, and make peace with someone this upcoming week. First episode in the books. Stay blessed, and we'll catch you next time.
Peace.